Artists in Our Midst welcomes their 20th anniversary by inviting the public to join them for two popular art events this spring. Event 1 is a free Roundhouse exhibit and birthday party on May 16th. One day only at the Roundhouse Community Center at 181 Roundhouse Mews in Yaletown. There will be an artist reception from 7 to 10 p.m. and don't miss out on the birthday cake bash at 8. Following up the birthday bash, there will be a free open studios walk on May 19th through the 21st. Studios will be open from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. and to see participating artists and a map, visit the website at artistsinourmidst.com.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
This May in Discorder, sit down for a chat with local thrash punk sensations New Sensei. Get well acquainted with Peace before their new album drops. Find out if Weed the Band is better than The Substance. And discover the response from members of Brestronaut on the controversy surrounding bands and crowdsourced funding. As always in Discorder, get your healthy dose of Venue News, Filmstrip, take a look at our beautiful calendar, browse the always-changing CITR program guide, tuck up bits of Mark DeLong's art project on your bedroom walls, take in some reviews of music both recorded and live, and all the other goodies you know and love. Pick up your beautiful and free copy of Discorder at any Friends of CITR business, or if you've gone paperless, don't forget to check out Discorder at discorder.ca. Discorder, that magazine from CITR, supporting local music for...
The world's most shocking monster.
That techno rock you guys listen to is godless.
I'm sure.
And the only reason you don't understand our music is that you don't like it.
After I'm gone, your Earth will be free to live out its miserable span of existence.
Can anyone stop their mechanical mail?
All of my most sensitive areas were inflamed. My extremities pulsating with tingling sensation.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology.
Swaying back and forth. A beautiful thing taking me away.
You are a robot.
You must listen to Synaptic Sandwich. Saturday nights from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. on CITR FM 101.9.
Today is Friday, May 11th. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Nina Carigia. You're listening to CITR News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening. It is 5:06 p.m. and time for another almost full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. We will also be talking to Joe Foy from the Wilderness Committee about the site Sea Dam on the Peace River, as well as Rizwan Pirzada, Regional Coordinator for the Amidaya Muslim Yamat, to discuss the upcoming interfaith colloquium titled How Do We Know God?
All this plus your weekend weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus and local headlines.
University of British Columbia researchers have found a potential way to develop universal flu vaccines and eliminate the need for seasonal flu vaccinations. Led by Professor John Schrader, Canada Research Chair in Immunology and Director of UBC Biomedical Research Centre, the research team found that the 2009 H1N1 swine flu vaccine triggers antibodies that protect against many influenza viruses, including the lethal avian H5N1 bird flu strain. The research team consists of scientists from UBC, the Universities of Ottawa and Toronto, the Ontario Agency for Health Protection and Promotion, the Canadian Food Inspections Agency, and the BC Centre for Disease Control. The research was supported by grants from the Canadian Institutes for Health Research, the International Consortium for Antivirals, and the Michael Smith Foundation for Health Research. Each year, seasonal influenza causes serious illnesses in 3 to 5 million people and 200,000 to 500,000 deaths. The 2009 H1N1 pandemic killed more than 14,000 people worldwide. Meanwhile, public health and bioterrorism concerns are heightened by the new mutations of the H5N1 bird flu virus, published last week by the journal Nature, that could facilitate infection among mammals and humans.
Some opponents of the proposed $5.5 billion Northern Gateway oil pipeline to Canada's Pacific Coast may not get a chance to be heard as scheduled by the regulatory panel looking at the plan because the federal government moves to streamline the country's environmental review process. George Hoberg, a UBC professor who specializes in environmental and natural resource policy, said U.S. green groups have found ways around similar restrictions, including fining local residents or even municipal councils and mayors who share their views on projects and agree to participate on their behalf. Holberg also said that such moves still do not address the larger issues of limiting opinions on important projects such as Northern Gateway, saying, quote, "I think that the direct impact test is far too narrow and a much broader public interest test is very valuable," end quote.
Five suspects have been arrested in the December 2011 Mexico murder of UBC PhD student Ximena Osuguenda Magana. Osuguenda, 39, was a Mexican national who had become a Canadian citizen. She lived in Montreal and Vancouver before departing to Mexico for a research project as part of a UBC doctoral degree in Hispanic studies. Osuguenda and her boyfriend were found dead on December 27th in Huatulco, Mexico. Local police have confirmed that the deaths were the result of a robbery and that Osuguenda had no criminal ties to the local drug activity. Three fugitives are still being sought in connection with the murder.
A study published Wednesday in the American Journal of Public Health conducted by the Gender and Sexual Health Initiative of the BC Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS and the University of British Columbia has determined that indoor sex workers face potentially life-saving benefits, including less violence, reduced exposure to HIV, and improved relationships with police. The study, led by UBC Assistant Professor of Medicine Kate Shannon, interviewed 39 women who previously worked on the street and now are living in two downtown Eastside buildings operated by the Atira Women's Resource Center and Rain City Housing and Support Society. The newest study found the supportive housing programs increased women's control over negotiating sex work transactions, including refusing to perform unwanted services, negotiating condom use, and avoiding violent predators, which contrasts with the safety afforded to women who negotiate sex work in clients' cars, dark alleys, and industrial areas. Said Shannon, quote, "The evidence is clear. We need to scale up access to safer sex workspaces and remove legal barriers to their formal implementation and evaluation," end quote.
after the conclusion of a drawn-out dispute between the UBC Senate and the Japanese-Canadian community, the honorary degrees that UBC agreed to grant to the 76 Japanese-Canadian students interning during World War II will be awarded in a ceremony on May 30th. The degrees are a newly created type of honorary designation based on similar degrees granted by the University of California in 2010. They are intended to recognize the historic injustice of forcing these UBC students to abandon their studies in 1942 and finally welcome them into the UBC alumni community. 23 of the students are still alive, while family representatives will collect the degrees on behalf of the deceased. The ceremony has been put together in consultation with members of the Japanese-Canadian community and will avoid dwelling too much on the tragic history of internment or honorees' ethnicity. Mary Kitagawa, a member of the Greater Vancouver Japanese-Canadian Citizens Association, who led the campaign for the honorary degrees, said the reaction of the former students was overwhelmingly positive. Kitagawa said she is grateful that UBC has finally decided to do the right thing. The ceremony takes place at the Chan Center at 4 p.m. on May 30th. Tickets are available for the general public.
The UBC region will now have an elected representative voting at the TransLink table. Legislation introduced by the provincial government Monday will give the director of Electoral Area A a voting seat on the Mayor's Council on Regional Transportation, which approves plans prepared by TransLink and appoints the Transit Authority's commissioner and board of directors. Electoral Area A is a wide swath of unincorporated Vancouver land, which includes all of the UBC campus. Electoral Area A Director Maria Harris said she hopes to use the seat to push for more reliable transit to UBC, as well as more long-term funding for transit projects. The voting members of the council include area mayors, as well as a representative from the Tsawwassen First Nation. Harris will be the first representative from an unincorporated area to be given a vote. AMS VP External Kyle Warwick was measured in his praise of the move, saying while it does provide something of a voice for the area, a better local governance model is still needed to fully represent UBC residents. But Warwick did say that the AMS is committed to working with Harris to ensure that she's an effective voice for students.
Those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We are going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for local weather forecast as well as your provincial and national news.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And now it is time for our weekend weather forecast with Phil, our favorite weather guy from the UBC Storm Club. Hi, Phil.
Thank you so much, Nina. And good evening, listeners. All right, guys. We live in Vancouver, a city that averages over 160 rainy days in a year. And we've had plenty of sunshine already this whole week. So, yeah, about the rain this coming weekend. Wait, what is this? Unbelievable. According to the model results, we are actually to anticipate not just great weather for this weekend, but most of next week too. In fact, if you visit Weather Canada's website right now and check out Vancouver's forecast for the next 7 days to come, your eyes will be dazzled by the line of seven bright yellow sunny icons on the screen. No? Well, at least mine were when I went there to cross-check my forecast. Anyway, honestly, this is a rare forecast to see here in the city. I say we all go out there and enjoy it. All right, now for your three-day weekend weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, no clouds, low of 12. Saturday, sunny with some clouds, high of 18, low of 15. Sunday, sunny, high of 18, low of 14. So that's your three-day weekend weather forecast for UBC, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Currently, it is 11 degrees here on UBC campus. I'm in the sub with CJ, Iqbal, Nina, and Claire. For News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
We are going to move on to our provincial and national headlines now. West Coast First Nations are planning to protest today at Enbridge's annual meeting of shareholders in Toronto. The Yinka Dene Alliance and supporters oppose a proposed pipeline that would cross their territory. The $5.5 billion Northern Gateway project would see crude oil from Alberta's oil sands moved through a twin pipeline more than 1,100 kilometers to the BC coast. From there, supertankers would ship the crude to Asia. The Alliance argues that the project poses a threat to the Aboriginals' way of life. Project opponents have been riding a freedom train from British Columbia to make their point in the country's financial heartland. The protesters, who have held rallies in various centers along the journey eastward, plan to march from a square several blocks east to the downtown hotel where the shareholders will be meeting. According to the Alliance, the pipeline would endanger the habitats of hundreds of rivers and streams it must cross and would have a drastic impact on First Nations communities if a spill occurred. Apart from the risk of spills from the pipeline itself, there are also concerns about a dramatic increase in tanker traffic along a pristine coastline and waterways that can be treacherous to navigate. More than 60 nations and Aboriginal organizations in BC, along with the Union of BC Municipalities, has declared their opposition to the project. Late last month, BC's opposition New Democrats formally objected to the proposal.
The British Columbia government today introduced changes and provided money aimed at slowing the increase in fares on BC ferries. Transportation and Infrastructure Minister Blair Lextrom said that fares are still likely to rise faster than inflation, and BC ferries will have to look for savings by doing things like canceling underused sailings. Lextrom said that the changes to the Coastal Ferry Act respond to recommendations made in a report by BC Ferry Commissioner Gord McAtee released in January. Ferry operators will again be able to use fares from the major routes between Vancouver Island and the mainland to subsidize smaller routes, a practice the government had ended with changes made in 2003. The Act also gives the Commissioner greater latitude to approve or order service reductions and undertake performance reviews. Between 2003 and 2011, fares on the major routes between Vancouver Island and the Lower Mainland increased by 47%, while on the minor and northern routes that increase was 80%. The government also announced it will contribute an extra $79.5 million to BC ferries over 4 or 5 years on top of the current annual $150 million subsidy. Lextrom said the province will start a public consultation very soon to determine a vision for the future of ferry services in the province.
Four suspects wanted in connection with a smoke bomb attack Thursday morning in Montreal's subway system turned themselves in today, this afternoon. Sources told QMI agency the four suspects came forward to Montreal police accompanied by their lawyers. Montreal's subway system was crippled Thursday morning following a coordinated smoke bomb attack that targeted three stations. It was the latest sign of social unrest tied to the student boycott against tuition fee increases, dubbed by some the Quebec Spring. However, no student group has taken responsibility for the attacks. Over 200,000 people were affected as the system ground to a halt for the first time in nearly 16 years. Thursday morning's attacks drove commuters to the streets, and police and firefighters were called to the scene. The Board of Trade of the Metropolitan Montreal estimated the city's economy lost $11 million for every hour the subway was out of service. Police said they are looking for more people in connection with the smoke attacks.
The Conservative government defended the cost of Canada's mission into Libya after National Defense unveiled today that the total bill was $347.5 million. Canada participated in a NATO mission last year, enforcing a no-fly zone over Libya in hopes to end the crackdown on pro-democracy protesters who wanted leader Muammar Gaddafi ousted. The $347.5 million includes costs such as salaries and fuel, that would have been spent even without a mission. The military pegs the mission alone cost at $103.6 million. This was still enough to rile opposition parties, who said Defense Minister Peter MacKay should have known that the mission's larger-than-estimated expense and then disclosed it. In October, MacKay told media outlets in Parliament that extra costs would hit $50 million, even though senior military officials said they estimated the extra cost to take part in the mission would be $106 million. Taxpayers also spent more than $800,000 on a flyover and ceremony to mark the successful Libya mission.
The wave of debris from the Japanese tsunami that is starting to wash up on the West Coast has prompted a call for volunteers to clean up the trash. The Vancouver Aquarium and the World Wildlife Fund are teaming up to recruit volunteers to pick up everything from bottles to plastics, fishing paraphernalia, to appliances that is expected to wash up on North America's coastline. Jill Dwyer from the Vancouver Aquarium is in charge of a registry of volunteers needed to collect the junk, and she said people can sign up for the cleanup registry at www.shorelinecleanup.ca. Dwyer said that, quote, "We really don't know when the majority of the debris is going to start hitting our shorelines, where it's going to hit or how much. What we're doing is just getting a list of volunteers who would be willing to help when needed, and then we'll connect them with the site coordinator or the local people on the ground who would actually be organizing the cleanup," end quote. Dwyer said that ocean debris could be harmful to wildlife if it contains chemicals or if animals ingest them or become entangled in them. According to some estimates, the March 2011 tsunami washed between 1.5 and 18 million tons of debris into the Pacific Ocean.
Those were your provincial and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but please do stay tuned for your international news.
This is my life. I wake up in the morning, I eat, I sleep, I shit.
Breakfast with the Browns.
Whatever it is, but I never shut it off for 5 minutes.
I can't wait to impress my friends with my astounding knowledge of cool.
Join your favorite Brownsters and tune in and listen to the best selection of down-tempo electro-pop lounge core.
Strictly Squaresville.
Remember, subtle, basic. Browns.
Breakfast with the Browns
on CITR 101.9 FM every Monday morning
from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
The older I get, the more life starts to make sense and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow, the clouds fit, and we're making it like him. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making it like you. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville.
Here's God standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Western Canada's largest independent music and arts festival, Sled Island, features over 200 bands, including Feist, The Hold Steady, Archers of Loaf, and Andrew WK. Sled Island also features comedy, film, and art at multiple venues in Calgary, Alberta, from June 20th through the 23rd. Festival passes are on sale now at sledisland.com. Get your sled on.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
April and Discorder is here. Daffodils are blooming, cherry blossoms blossoming, and Discorder smells spring fresh off the presses. Check inside for monthly faves, The Overeducated Grumbler, on the topic of Dan Levy, getting textually active with rock stars, and news on the venues you know and love. Read up on the lovelies of Ruffled Feathers, Indigo Kids, and Dirty Spells, and figure out where to pick up hard copies of their stuff at your favorite local record store on Record Store Day. Reviews, calendars, charts, interviews, art projects, photos, write-ups, and teardowns, all that and more in your free April issue of Discorder. Pick up your beautiful and free copy of Discorder at any Friends of CITR business, or if you've gone paperless, don't forget to check out Discorder at discorder.ca. Discorder.
And welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Claire Eagle, and it's now time for our interview with members from the Ahmadiyya Muslim Jamaat. We're going to discuss their upcoming interfaith colloquium titled, How Do We Know God? So it's my pleasure to welcome Mr. Lal Cotton Malik and Rizwan Pirzada to our show.
Yes, good evening. This is Lal Malik from Toronto.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to have you here. So we know that you have the Interfaith Colloquium coming up on May 22nd here at UBC. So can you tell us a bit about that event?
Yes, I look forward to attend this symposium, and I believe that the question of whether God does exist and how do we experience him is like asking a man, are you alive? Do you have a soul? So for a man of faith, a question of whether God does exist or not, it's like asking him, are you alive?
And what will be the different faiths present at the symposium?
In the symposium, we are expecting scholars from Christianity, Judaism, and another faith, perhaps Hinduism, who would be participating, and we would be representing point of view of Islam.
So that's definitely very interesting, because obviously there, between faiths, there's different interpretations of the experience of God. How will these differences be addressed, and what kind of dialogue can we expect to see?
Your question is not clear to me. Would you please repeat?
Mm-hmm. So what kind of dialogues are you expecting to see between the different faiths?
I expect that we would be listening to the concept of God by believers of various faiths, their point of view, their experience, how they experience God in their lives. And it would be an excellent opportunity of looking at different facets of this issue.
What is the end result of this that you guys are hoping to achieve? Is it some sort of harmony between religions? That's what I would expect from something like this, but is that what the end result is?
I think the end result would be that we would have a better understanding of the concept of God according to various faiths, and it would be a positive influence on the belief that concept of God has a soothing effect on the behavior of people. I believe that true faith in God is necessary for true morality to exist. No true morals can exist without belief in existence of God.
And has the Ahmadiyya Muslim Jamaat held events like this before, or symposiums like this before?
Yes, we are holding such symposia throughout Canada, and more than 100 of these events are scheduled every year in Canada and in other countries also. And through this interfaith dialogue, we aim to bring together people of faith from various religions. And this is one way in which we are contributing to the peace in society, because the worst enemy of the world today is ignorance of other people. When we know more about other faiths, we would have less apprehensions, and we would have a better understanding about one another. And this would bring us closer and would ensure cooperation between various faiths.
Yeah, it's definitely something that's so relevant. And I think understanding is really at the keystone of it, especially when faith is such a personal experience for so many people. And I think finding that understanding between people can often be the most difficult, but also the most rewarding. I guess, what kind of attendance do you expect to see? Is this something for scholars or for students or for both?
I think we expect attendance from both. And anyone of the academia and the students who are interested in knowing the influence of belief in God in our lives would be willing to attend, and I hope good attendance.
Awesome. Is there anything else you'd like to add about the event?
I would add at the end that we, the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, is trying to bring about peace through holding these symposia, and our slogan of love for all, hatred for none, is the driving force behind it, because we believe that when we would bring together people of various faiths on one platform, this would bring peace and love and cooperation.
Wow, I feel inspired already. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So that was Mr. Lal Khan Malik from the Ahmadiyya Muslim Jamaat discussing their upcoming interfaith colloquium that will be happening on May 22nd from 6 to 9:30 in Buchanan A101 here at UBC. So it sounds like a great colloquium. There'll be representatives from a lot of different faiths there. And the title of the colloquium is How Do We Know God? It is now time for your international headlines. But first, we're going to take a quick break.
Standing on a planet, really I'm just a speck, compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
This plane is definitely crashing!
Bad Bird Events and CITR present the Main Street Vinyl Record Fair, Sunday, May 27th at a new venue, the Cambrian Hall on 17th and Main. The Main Street Vinyl Record Fair, now bigger, brighter, and with more records than ever before. Featuring music by the Knights of the Turntable. And free with admission, the Vinyl Fair Discount Card. Get 10% off all vinyl purchases at participating record stores across Vancouver. The Main Street Vinyl Record Fair, Sunday, May 27th at the Cambrian Hall on 17th and Main. Go to www.vinylrecordfair.com or find us on Facebook for more information.
Welcome back. Before we move on, we just wanted to add that the Ahmadiyya Jamaat colloquium discussion, How Do We Know God, that will be happening on May 22nd, is open to the public and free of charge. Now we are moving on to our international headlines, courtesy of FSRN.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. The U.S. Department of Justice has filed a civil lawsuit against Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio. The suit contends that the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office continues to engage in a pattern of profiling Latinos, discriminatory practices against Latino inmates, and retaliation. Assistant U.S. Attorney Thomas Perez spoke at a press conference Thursday.
Nobody is above the law, and nobody can misuse the legal process to silence those with different opinions. Now, leadership starts at the top, and all of the alleged violations outlined in the complaint are the product of a culture of disregard for basic rights within MCSO that starts at the top and pervades the entire organization.
The Justice Department says a proposed reform agreement was unsuccessful because the sheriff would not agree to independent monitoring. Justice says Latinos in Maricopa County are stopped 4 to 9 times more often than other drivers. The sheriff's office released a document Wednesday outlining their efforts to reform, but Perez called the action too little, too late. In Oakland, California, the former transit security officer who killed Oscar Grant on a train station platform 3 years ago is attempting to have his conviction for involuntary manslaughter overturned. Johannes Messerly shot Grant in the back on New Year's Day in 2009 while the young man was lying face down on the ground. Today, his family voiced indignation over the appeal. FSRN's George Lavender reports.
Family and friends of Oscar Grant reacted angrily to the news that Johannes Messerly had appeared in court Wednesday to try to have his conviction overturned. Messerly's lawyer said his client should never have been convicted and called the shooting an error. At trial, Messerly claimed he meant to use his taser on Grant and instead shot him in the back. Videos of Grant's killing sparked an uprising in Oakland, as did the reduced verdict of involuntary manslaughter. The former transit officer was released last summer after 11 months in prison. Oscar Grant's family said they were not informed that the hearing was going to take place. His mother, Wanda Johnson, said she was upset by the news that Messerly wanted to work as a police officer again.
To allow someone back on the force like that would be a disgrace to our community, to our society, and it would be a slap in the face to me and my family. He knew exactly what he was doing. There was no mistake made.
Messerly would need his felony conviction overturned in order to return to police work. According to Grant's family, the district attorney apologized for not informing them of the hearing. George Lavender, FSRN, Oakland.
Two police officers in Fullerton, California, are going to stand trial for the brutal beating death of a mentally ill homeless man last July. Police video of the incident shows officers telling Kelly Thomas to get on the ground. When Thomas does not follow repeated orders, officers Manuel Ramos and Corporal J. Patrick Cicinelli use a baton to beat him. Later, this is heard.
Sorry, dude. I'm sorry, dude. Please.
Five days later, Kelly Thomas died of his injuries. A coroner pathologist said in court this week his death was caused by chest compressions and blunt cranial injuries. Charges against the officers range from second-degree murder to felony manslaughter. Another officer could also face charges. The Securities Exchange Commission has opened an investigation into J.P. Morgan after the bank announced losses of $2 billion yesterday. The New York Times reports the SEC is looking into potential civil violations associated with the loss. A national campaign fighting exorbitant phone rates prisoners often pay to call their loved ones is holding a Mother's Day of Action today, collecting stories of families affected. The Prison Phone Justice Campaign blames government kickbacks for the high rates. Stephen Renderos is an organizer of the Mother's Day of Action.
Is an opportunity to elevate stories from families, from people who have loved ones behind bars. And we're going to send those stories directly to the FCC because the Federal Communications Commission has a direct role to play in addressing the rates of phone calls within prison.
Lee Petro, a lawyer and expert on prison telephone service contracts, says that monopolies that benefit phone companies and give commissions to state governments are driving the system.
In states where there are pre-existing contracts that involve commissions that are being paid to the local governments or the state governments, a 15-minute phone call can cost more than $20.
Advocates say high prison phone prices can drive a wedge between inmates and their families, which, in the long run, burdens society. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Thank you to FSRN for those headlines. We are going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for more news on CITR 101.9 FM.
You wish to make an apple pie from scratch. You must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Vengeance.
stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The horizon of the Milky Way.
The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Nina Krigia. And we are talking to Joe Foy, the National Campaign Director for the Wilderness Committee. Hi, Joe.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, so we're discussing today the Site C Dam on the Peace River. So I guess just for our listeners who aren't as aware of that project, could you just bring them up to speed on what that is?
Well, the Site C Dam project, Site C is just BC Hydro's name for a particular place on the Peace River up by Fort St. John, is a proposed dam site that would flood almost 100 kilometers of river, both tributaries and the main stem of the Peace River, as well as 5,000 acres of farmland and a whole bunch of wildlife habitat and important historical areas for First Nations and their non-native neighbors. The Peace River has had two dams on it already, the W.A.C. Bennett Dam and the Peace Dam, and so this will be the third dam on the Peace River. But we say, we being in many environmentalists and environmental groups all over the province, as well as all the First Nations and in the area, and even far into Alberta and the Northwest Territories who have felt the impacts of the previous dams, we say that there's already been too much damage. There should not be a further dam, the Site C Dam.
And I know you were quoted as saying that the Site C would require the largest single deletion of agricultural land in the province's history, which is pretty amazing. Is this something, do you feel like citizens are aware enough of this?
Well, I think that people have been aware actually for decades about the Site C Dam. It would require the largest deletion from the agricultural land reserve. And we got the agricultural land reserve legislation in the 70s. And this would be the biggest attack that we've ever seen since we got that great piece of legislation. The Site C Dam has been fought back twice before. And the reason it's been people have been successful is that we've up until now had something called the BC Utilities Commission, which is an arm's-length commission that is to look at these projects to see if they're good for the people of B.C. And both times they've looked at the Site C, they've determined that it's too expensive, it's not good for the province, and we lose too much. Mm-hmm. The problem is our government in Victoria has passed legislation which removes the B.C. Utilities Commission's right to look at Site C.
Okay.
So that's... we're in a very scary situation right now.
And, of course, this dam is being built for energy. What's the argument in terms of if somebody was to say, well, how are we going to get our alternate energy if it isn't built? Is there some sort of payoff, like something else we can be doing instead for creating energy?
Well, British Columbia is awash in hydroelectric power. We certainly don't need any more electricity to keep our lights on. Our neighbors in Washington State have more hydroelectric power than they can use. In fact, there's a story in today's Vancouver Sun about BC Hydro has actually got to allow most of the water these days to spill over its dams because it has too much electricity. They keep changing their story, the provincial government, as to why we need Site C. They used to try to tell us we needed it to keep our lights on. Lately, they've been hinting we need it to run liquefied natural gas plants so we can ship a liquefied natural gas to Asia. And we say that's a very, very dodgy financial reason for flooding 100 kilometers of valley and drowning so much farmland. We have more electricity than we can possibly use at the moment, yet we only produce half the food that we eat. So we would argue that our food production in British Columbia, a very mountainous place, we need to keep our eye on that. We have enough electricity to live within our means.
So it looks like currently it's only communities in the Peace River region who are actually being granted the public open house meetings. Obviously, this is something that impacts larger communities than that. So what is it that the Wilderness Committee would ask instead?
Well, we've been very concerned with the limits to democracy that have seemed to be strangling both British Columbia and our entire nation as governments both provincially and federally change the rules on environmental review. We've already heard, I've already explained how the BC Utilities Commission has been pushed out of the way. They can no longer look at Site C. Now we're very concerned that the environmental review process, their first public series of public meetings, are only to be held in the immediate vicinity of the proposed dam site. We say that's absolutely wrong. We say that people around the province have a right and actually a responsibility to speak out against human rights abuses. And Site C would be a human rights abuse, in our view, because of the unified opposition by local First Nations who do not want to see is such important parts of their territory flooded. We say that all the people of the province deserve an opportunity to go to a public meeting because many communities have felt the sting of loss of farmland and would want to tell the environmental assessment face-to-face of how they feel about not losing any more farmland. But most importantly, many British Columbians are struggling to make ends meet. This is climbing to an $8 billion project for power we don't need. And a very dodgy financial scheme to sell natural gas to China and other parts of Asia. So this impacts every ratepayer. It impacts everyone who wants to see our hospitals properly funded. It impacts everyone in the province who's concerned about their local schools and lack of funding for their schools. Site C has a huge negative impact on all these things, and it's wrong to limit the public participation to only those who live around the dam site.
I'm kind of starting to sense that this Site C is a little bit in connection with the entire pipeline issues and exporting to China. Are you guys doing any sort of collaboration with other organizations, environmental organizations in the province?
Well, we certainly are. I mean, the Wilderness Committee is very involved in both the fight against the Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline and the Kinder Morgan pipeline, Trans Mountain pipeline, that would lure more and more oil tankers to fill up on dirty tar sands crude right in Vancouver Harbor. We're involved in both of those. As well, we've allied ourselves with the Treaty 8 First Nations and their allies. So there's a whole group of First Nations that go all the way down the Peace River system, who have been heavily impacted by the current two dams. Their regulation of the water has cut off a lot of wildlife habitat and drowned a lot of very important places. Caribou herds have almost disappeared in some areas. So we work both with environmental groups and with many, many First Nations groups to stop the Site C Dam. It's all connected. Government alludes to the fact they need the Site C Dam to run their natural gas schemes. Natural gas, of course, doesn't just flow to China. It flows the other way to cook the tar sands. It's natural gas which makes the tar sands operation possible. So it's all connected. It all results in climate change, destroyed farmland, destroyed environment. And the way to stop it is good old-fashioned activism and a healthy dose of democracy.
And how would people be able to participate, to show their democracy and participate in this if they would like?
Well, there's a few ways. One way, we're urging people to write in to the environmental review process. One way you can do that is to go to the Wilderness Committee's website, wildernesscommittee.org, where we have a connection, a letter-writing tool, which allows you to write directly to that process. Another way is to get in touch with your elected representative, your MLA, and your MP, and email them or phone them at their constituency office and demand that open house public meetings be held all around the province. This is a massive mega project with massive impacts to everyone in the province.
Well, great. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us, Joe. We really learned a lot, and it's definitely pushing us to act right now. So thank you.
Well, thanks for giving me the opportunity.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So that was Joe Foy, the National Campaign Director for the Wilderness Committee, discussing the Site C Dam on the Peace River. So if you would like more information, you can always go to their website,
wildernesscommittee.org, and there is a button right here that you can click. It says Take Action if you would like to participate in your own democracy.
And so now we're just going to go back to some more international news.
Courtesy of FSRN.
Across the country fought to keep alive a lawsuit they've filed against the U.S. government. Plaintiffs say EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson, Interior Department Secretary Ken Salazar, Defense Secretary Robert Gates, and others have failed to confront climate change and protect the environment for future generations. The suit was filed in May of last year, and today U.S. District Court Judge Robert Wilkins heard a motion from industry groups, including the National Association of Manufacturers, to dismiss the suit. 17-year-old Alec Lors is the main plaintiff in the case. He spoke to FSRN via mobile phone as he left the courthouse today.
It's difficult for young people because all the plaintiffs in this case are young people, most under 18, and we don't really have, we can't vote. There's no way we can compete with the corporate lobbyists, so this is actually one of the main ways that we can exercise our rights.
Lors, who founded Kids vs. Global Warming when he was 12 years old, said their lawsuit is an attempt to break the stalemate in U.S. Congress. It argues that the atmosphere is a public trust and lawmakers are obligated to preserve it.
Our government has the legal responsibility to protect the atmosphere as a public trust and protect it for future generations and present generations. And we're basically saying that our current government has failed at that. They've failed to protect our atmosphere.
The judge is expected to make a decision on whether the suit can move forward in the coming weeks. As youth continue their fight for climate change, U.S. lawmakers in the Capitol took a step this week to strip funding for an important international climate change fund. Republicans unveiled the $40 billion spending bill on Tuesday for foreign aid and State Department programs. The bill ends support for the Clean Technology and Strategic Climate Funds. The program's stated goal is to promote low-carbon technologies and reduce greenhouse emissions and is administered by the World Bank. The House bill is under review. But while the U.S. fails to support policies to stop climate change, its neighbor, Mexico, just passed a comprehensive climate change bill, making it one of the only countries in the world to approve legally binding emission reductions. The new measure, which has yet to be signed into law by President Felipe Calderon, would reduce carbon emissions, end fossil fuel subsidies, and create a voluntary carbon trading market. For more, we're joined by Dr. Vanessa Perez-Cerera, Director of Climate and Energy Programs for World Wildlife Fund Mexico. She joins us from Mexico City. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very happy to be with you.
Well, getting into some of the specifics of the law, emission reductions has been a key sticking point in international negotiations about exactly what percentage and compared to what levels. What does this law lay out for the reductions of carbon emissions?
That's a very interesting point. There's a recommendation, kind of a general recommendation that to stay below 2 degrees centigrade before the end of this century, the IPCC, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has recommended that developed nations reduce their emissions by 80% before 2050, and developing countries reduce their emissions by 50% before 2050.
So this law does lay out that 50% reduction of carbon emissions by 2050.
Exactly. It also lays out another goal, which is 30% reduction by 2020, which is actually a quite an ambitious reduction target for 2020. So we have to move fast, and we also expect to be receiving international attention and international support for technology transfer and other to enable us to reach this goal.
And are there enforcement mechanisms in place for this? It's one thing to set goals. It's another to implement them fully and have consequences if they're not implemented. Are there ways to ensure that these goals are reached?
Well, there are in the law, you have a sanction system. At the moment, that sanction system, the sanction system is related to information disclosure by industries and by the different sectors. These are is a mandate by Mexico as such to the executive, and it's something that the legislative sector or the legislative force or power needs to hold the executive accountable to.
We've spoken about the emissions side of energy production. What about the other side, about energy production itself and renewable resources? What does this law say about that?
Well, exactly as you said, in terms of renewables, the law states clearly that the Mexico should transit towards a low carbon economy, towards a low carbon society, and away from fossil fuels, and that renewable energy should be promoted, and either on internalizing the externality costs on the conventional energy production and phasing out fossil fuel subsidies to make renewable energy as competitive as other sources, because